Okay, thanks for inviting me here. And we're going to talk a little bit about looking back at some of the progress we've made in soybeans. I'll have to spend the last part of the talk a little bit on looking forward with some of the colleagues I've been working with. But you also have the other session as well that's going to look forward. So I guess I click right here. Back in 1981, I gave a talk back then on a symposium that led to contributions to genetic gains in five crops, and this is, it's the mouse, oh, there we go. This is what that line looked back then, and all these things you'll be looking at, you'll see yield in the English system on this axis, and yield in the metric system on this axis. You can look over there too as well. So I just look over here because it's a little closer. So it's just a linear regression equation here, 3.311 bushels per acre per year. If in metric, it's 20.93. So when we looked at it back then, we only had 57 points. And whoops, wrong way, sorry. And then back in Baltimore meeting in 1998, it was on another session that wasn't the genetics one, but you see this had gone up a little bit. We now had 75 points, and now this is a 22. And what you didn't see there, and I'll just back it up, is there's just a little bit of a bump in the rise there. And if you go further now to today's date, which includes 2009 data, we now have 86 points. You can see we're up at 0.34 bushels per acre per year, or 23.16. Now I'm going to go backwards here just so you can see the change in that line. You'll notice that the tip is rising at the end. So actually, when you look at this, it appears that we're getting a little steeper gain as we go forward in terms of that linear regression coefficient. Okay. So how does annual improvement in yield come about? And we're talking about on-farm annual improvement here because these are the USDA statistics. You got genetic technology, of course, continual release and rapid adoption of the newest and ever-higher yielding cultivars. Used to be from the public programs, and in a few cases still is, but now pretty much dominated by the proprietary sector. You have agronomic technologies, you know, periodic development, adoption of more effective management tools and strategies that you can talk about. And here's one I took down here I called genetic and agronomic technology synergism. You'll see that often the highest yielding varieties are often the best advantages, best capable of taking advantage of this. And I don't have an example from soybeans, but I do from wheat, published by Rouse et al. Down here, and if you just concentrate down here in the bottom part of this slide, they were comparing new and old cultivars across the stability index, environmental index down here, and you see the new cultivars are the open circles and the old ones are the black, but you can see in the water scarce environments down here, the newer ones were beating the older ones. And even on the high end of the spectrum down here, high index, they were still beating them. So when you develop a new variety, I'll talk about that just a little bit later, you're also steepening its response to the abiotic factors in the environment. And that's what you call RUE or WE or whatever you want to look at that way. Now, of course, other considerations that can come in play, the rise in atmospheric CO2 has been pretty steady. You can see this on the slide. I just pulled this down here. A couple days ago, measured by Keeling, it's gone up from around 315 now to about 385 and in 2008. And so this really is also a rise in carbon fertilization, really, for soybeans. The C3 species will benefit from that. The implication is that 1.4 parts per million on a volume basis contributes about 2 to 5 kilograms per hectare per yield in soybeans. So, and I just had a session over here this morning where they talked about a doubling would lead to 37% or 34% in C3 crops like soybeans. Soybeans are also benefiting from the situation where they're now grown more in rotation with corn. Corn used to occupy the best cropland, and often two years or 3 years of corn before you grew soybeans. Now it's more equal. So, and both yield better when they're produced together. We've demonstrated that in Lincoln. It's at least a significant advantage to grow both of them together because they yield more when they've done that. And, of course, the research and development funding levels will improve as that annual gain in ways that contribute to, you know, the research that's done both in a basic sense and an applied sense. Now, I'd like to concentrate on the productivity here because I call that increased yield potential per se. You can get more yield if you protect your varieties, your newest cultivars or hybrids from the impact of biotic factors. But really, this is just preserving what you have. You'll also have to steadily increase your gains. And of course, this takes time away when you're doing it in the breeding program. And of course, breeding for quality is another issue. You know, in soybeans, we have to monitor our protein and oil and have special kind of oil now. And so these can detract you from this main goal, but annual yields arise because of the increase in yield potential that we'll talk about. Now, here's the way I define it here. You look at crop yield, any specific resource, light, water, nitrogen, whatever you want to call it. You generally have a couple areas down here I call the resource insufficiency points. This would be on areas where you either got too much shade or not enough water or not enough nitrogen, where those come into play. At the upper end, of course, you're up here where you can't yield any more than the amount of light and water and other things you're given. It's not an infinite supply of food from our crop production from a finite supply of light and water and energy. But here's where most of us operate down here, and we have evidence in soybeans. I'm not going to be able to show you that there is some variation down here in these crisscrossing across this period down here. So, but those are the three main areas that breeders would be interested in: the stress breeding down here, the high yield breeding for the most of us, the rest of us in here. Oops. Now, years ago, I did a study when I compared the old varieties versus new ones back then. These were the introductions, and these were the ones that resulted from hybridization. And I noticed the distinct discontinuity right along in the 1940s. These cultivars all came from direct introductions. These came from hybridization, the progeny of hybridization. And so you can see there's some definite breakpoints in there. And if we look at that further, what I calculated down at that breakpoint, there was a 25% one-time jump in yields for soybeans. That would be very similar to the going from open pollinated corn to hybrid corn. So we had experienced the same thing in soybeans. Now, there's been a lot of studies since then by all these people listed in here early on in the 70s and the early 80s, or around about 15 to 20 in here. And here's the, those are in kilograms per hectare. This would be in bushels per acre down there. So you're really talking about a quarter of a bushel per acre back then. James Wilcox, before he retired, published the results of some data he had from the Northern Uniform test trials, and he calculated genetic rates of improvement of in the 20 to 30 range, which is very close to the range that we're seeing in on-farm yield improvement. This is not to say that agronomic practices have not had a role, because as I mentioned early, the higher yielding varieties also benefit from the higher yields resulting from good management practices. Now, there's been some that would claim that soybean breeders are pretty slow lot, you know, that just can't keep up with the corn breeders. And even had one National Academy Science member tell me that at a national meeting one time, and I really had to put him straight. And what you see here is the corn yields in Nebraska. And I use irrigated there so we can eliminate the effect of stress at different times of the year. And what you see here, here's the trend line for corn. Here's the trend line for soybeans. And if you were to look at that, you'd say, yeah, soybean breeders are just walking while the corn breeders are galloping. But that's not really true from the standpoint, you know, corn is intrinsically more productive in the first place, C4 versus C3. Corn is mostly carbohydrate. Plant an acre of corn, you get some bags of flour when you're done, and I tell my class, in soybean you get a smorgasbord of protein and lipid, but they still go for the carbohydrate because they want to make beer out of it now, ethanol, so. And of course, the soybeans has to, depends a lot on making its own nitrogen through the fixation step, which is a little more, takes a little more and more photosynthetic energy than does nitrate reduction. Of course, you have to supply all this for corn. But in the end result, if you put them on that 3-to-1 scale and show them this way, where you got, you take a look at the Nebraska irrigated yields here, and this is on farm improvement again. You see they're nearly matched. So on a relative scale, the soybean breeders, you can raise your hands and shout, we're doing as good as the corn breeders, okay? So don't let the corn breeders get you down here. So now, Nebraska, that 3-to-1 ratio has all showed up for a very, very long time. Dennis Eggley published a paper here a year ago or so, showed that 3-to-1 ratio on a metric scale applies pretty much throughout the north central region, but we've known it in Nebraska for a long time, and we tell farmers if they're not getting this 3-to-1 ratio on their corn soybean rotation, they're mismanaging one of their crops. So we don't tell them which one, but it's usually the soybean one. So. Now, what about soybean agronomics, past and current improvements? Earlier planting, I think, has paid off in Nebraska, at least, and some of the north central, where I've been reading the recent reports. Dennis Eggley and I disagree with a little bit about that, but we think in the northern part we're experiencing some yield gain because of that. A lot more narrow rows have been grown now, too, as well, to intercept the light earlier in the season. Improved planting equipment for no-till. Soybean wears the brunt of no-till. Nobody ever plants their corn into ground as good as old soybean ground. Or they do, I should say. So soybean is better to follow, at least, than corn is in that regard. Got better weed control on soybeans nowadays with glyphosate resistance. You don't see a single weed anywhere in the field if they're managing it properly. No-till is added to improve soil water management. And properly timed irrigation that we do in Nebraska has shown that we can get more yield actually with a little less water. Improved harvest equipment. Some of these combines these days will get very close to the ground. And the soybean fraction of the producer's best farmland is rising as well. So I don't know how much contribution that's making to the yield. And right now there's a lot of research going on both field site and time-specific management tools. So all these are contributing to yield. So the key question here then, though, is will this trend continue? Obviously, I've just fit the best linear regression line here of about a third of a bushel per acre per year, or about 23 kilograms per hectare per year here. Now, we went back here and I thought, well, maybe there's some trend in there I can't see, and this requires some sophisticated time series analysis tools that I'm not so good at. So I went to a website where they take a look at this over a longer period of time. It's called the, this is the website here, and it's taking a look at trends in the data. You can see there's a trend in the CO2 data of up and down each annual season from photosynthesis in the summer drawing down the CO2, and then it rises back up in the winter. And you see in that when you do the statistical test here, you can pick out that annual or semi-annual cycle or wave if you want to see it there. But when I put the soybean data in there, I didn't see anything that was significant pop out. So admittedly, you know, we only have 86 data points here compared to the thousands they use and looking at tree rings and other things. But certainly, I don't see anything here. Stuff that popped up early is not present anymore. And we also know there's got to be a biological limit. You know, I use the term when I teach my class, of the famous newspaper person that was answering a reply to the young girl who was questioning about Santa Claus. I would say, yes, soybean breeders, there ain't no Santa Claus. I mean, you can't keep this going straight up. There is a biological limit, and it'll show up here no matter what you're looking at. Andy Witt showed that many years ago using some reasonable assumptions, calculating all the possible elemental masses and energy, and for 40 degrees latitude, using the light energy that's intercepted coming is about 45 tons per hectare, 45,000 kilo per hectare. The 50% harvest index, that would translate into about 22.5 tons per acre, 22,500 kilos per hectare. Now, my colleague Ken Cashman works a lot on this area on yield potential, and which is defined here as what you could grow in the absence of any abiotic stress and without water stress. Here's what you would get in the experiment station yields, somewhat less. This would be the farmers that win yield contests, or at least work at the upper level, and then of course you got the average farmer, which is the trend line we're looking at. And you see all these account for yield gaps. So if there is a maxima up there, and we believe there is a biological limit, our next phase of research in the next, for this millennium, will be try to narrow that gap. And for soybeans, if we disregard some outliers that I don't think, well, let me just call them incredible. I'm not saying they're cheating or anything, but just a little bit incredible. If you take a look at the ones that seem to fall within the pack, so to speak, for soybeans, the yield limit would be about 8,000 kilos per hectare, about 120 bushels per acre. Tom Sinclair talks about a 7,300 limit when he talks about radiation use efficiency and water, transpiration. And he also talks about nitrogen, which I won't get into here, too, because some of these root crops like this would require a lot of nitrogen to get gone. But if you use that 3-to-1 ratio here and you take some of the top corn yields and you divide them by 3, you get to about the same limit of 7,300 to 8,000 the same way. So there's a lot of consistency in all these things that we're looking at. Dick Cooper published this before he retired, showed all the record holders back in the 60s. And, of course, some of them were getting up into the $6,000 and $7,000 range, including him himself. A couple Australians down here, a couple of papers there where they're around 8,000, a little bit more. So all these seem to be consistent. Now remember, when you're looking at a trend line, each point in each year that I've looked at that blue trend line, it's going to represent a population of farmers. I use this as an example from one of Ken Castman's papers to show that you have producers either that can't get very high yields and those that do, and all those go together to make up the yield mean average. You have the experiment station yields for the cultivars they're using, and this would represent the standard error for those. So this is kind of a nice way to look at that. All you have to do is superimpose that on top of each date there, because this line, this point, represents the average of many, many counties in the United States that report yields. And so you got, over each line, you got a distribution ranging from the farmers that don't have the best resources of land to those that do. That's a mean. So keep that in mind. If there is a biological limit, we're going to fall short of it because we're dealing with a mean of a population of producers and not just one producer. Now, there are some efficiency limits as well. Harvest index has risen substantially over time, but you can't get it much greater than 0.55. I'm not going to show a lot of data because of time constraints here, but just indicate what the maximum might be. Whoops. Biomass yield, of course, Sinclair's dwelt on that, shows that in soybeans, about 1.1 grams of dry matter per megajoule. RUE basically is that response factor of yield to radiation intercepted and utilized. And I've worked a bit in drought, and of course, biomass yield is also equal to a water use exchange constant here, because when CO2 comes in, water escapes, and this is the proportionality constant for that. And obviously, to get more yield, you have to have more transpiration, in spite of what people think. What you have here is an efficiency in that transpiration relative to the amount of biomass you get, but ultimately, to get high yields, you have to have transpiration, because that means your stomata are open. Okay, and here's what that looks like. If we could make soybean from a C3 species into a C4 species, we had a big jump in the water use efficiency. Harvest index changes would occur like this, but they're trying to do that in rice, but nobody's attempted that in soybeans yet. So now if you take the linear regression that I've got for these points, and oops, a little ahead of myself there, and you put the confidence intervals for that regression, it's pretty tight because of the number of points we have, and you put the prediction band around that in turn, you get this kind of prediction for the within sample new drawing of a new point. But you can also fit an exponential equation to that data, which I've done here in using nonlinear regression with the R software. And what you see here, then, this would average about 0.13%. compounded rate of gain. So whenever you're dealing with an exponential, you got to talk about compounding. When you're dealing with a linear, it's just like you're getting simple interest at the bank. They just add the money at the end of the year to your bank account, and that's what you move forward. It's not compounded, okay? So people get confused about relative rate of change and fixed and exponential. So you can see this fits just as well in terms of the R squared. Of course, what you have to do in the case of soybeans or any other crop, there is a biological limit that as you approach it, it's going to start slowing down. I call that the K imputed yield limit. And this is just a logistic equation here. Just using a simple factor here where this is the inflection point where the acceleration slows down to become a deceleration. And so if you apply that, that's the green line here, and that also fits with a pretty good R square as well. You don't see what happens to the rest, of course, because it's tailing off up here. But this is what happens if you extrapolate it to the year 2200, which is a long way from now, obviously. And probably by then we'll have solved what photosystem 2 does anyway, and so we'll have an unlimited source of energy just by using light energy to break up water. But just for your information here, all these were fit with good R-squares of this curve. the exponential obviously being unrealistic, but I'll come back to that in a moment. Linear just taking us straight out here, and of course the green line surprisingly only brings us to 6,000, but again remember we're talking about a population of people here, and so it's not surprising that it's tailing off to the limit, which I didn't set, but which the nonlinear regression software estimated was going to be about 6,000 kilos per hectare. Now you have some people that tell us that it's going to be far different than this. You have one person, chief technology officer for a well-known firm, saying they're going to use their technology to double yield. So that's going to be even faster than the exponential rate. So you've got to move from the 37 bushels per acre here, or the about a little less than 3,000, all the way up to doubling it up here to 74 or so in from 2000 to the year 2030. Now, there's a recent paper just in PNAS that says, no, what's not going to happen in the U.S. with global climate change is we're going to head downward by 80% because the temperature accounts for more of the crop yield than does the water. I expect Thompson, Clare, and I will have to talk about that because this is a little bit nebulous. In fact, both of these, as they fall out of this, bring up my hype to reality ratio. So both those cases, they're probably way up here. Okay. Hype to reality ratio is the amount of hype you're getting versus the reality of the technology you're going to put in the case. So, in fact, if you had one of Infinity, it'd be off the chart, but most of them plunge below the chart later on, in terms of that. But eventually, we find a lot of good uses for our technology, and you get a hype to reality ratio of unity. Now, what about the future of soybean breeding? We now have the Williams 82 genome sequence completed. We need to now look, I think, towards genomic diversity via resequencing long after I'm gone. We need to actually get a sequence for every variety that's ever been released to find out how they're different. It'll be a while before we can do that, but I got some good colleagues here that I work with in Beltsville, that David Heighton in particular, he's going to be talking tomorrow. You're going to genotype the whole soybean germplasm collection with 50,000 SNPs. This is a good start. You know, when you're doing the human one, you're talking millions, but this is a good start for a crop. It'll be a very useful resource, I think, for true molecular breeding to come to fore in the future, where we actually have genotypic information before we have phenotypic information. And finally, I think a lot of research went into identifying crop domestication genes, and that was the easy thing to do. I say that, it wasn't that easy, but I say it. Because now it's time to identify the yield improvement genes, which is going to be a lot tougher task. This is where breeders left their signature in the crop by altering gene frequency. Again, we come back to this. What we're interested here is how does this change here over time? This gets steeper over time as breeders, whatever you're talking about, improve their cultivars. Here's what I talk about here, where, okay, maybe we reached the genetic yield potential for genotypically. Maybe we can't push this line down here for drought tolerance anymore, but we can still steepen this VO curve, if you're an enzymology guy like I used to be, called it a KM over here, but if this becomes steeper, we still get both yield, we get both drought tolerance and better water use efficiency, because down here you can see at this point, we can get higher yield for the same amount of water in this case, whoops, back up, or if you're an environmentalist, you can tell the farmers they can get the same yield for less water, okay? So it works both ways in this case, so it's kind of nice. But I think the future lies in doing some of the things they've been able to do in humans. And when I read this paper, I was really kind of enthused about it, because what they do is they take the lactose intolerant gene in humans and trace it back and find that there's a selection signature in the human genome for those northern European populations that developed dairy cows and so on, were able to then select for mutations that occurred in lactose tolerance. So this is pretty great, because if we can find breeder selection signatures in the gene, and that'll go a long way to help us understand where breeding has taken us. And this just shows that signature that's in that in the human genome at this point, where the lactose tolerance arises. So, I think I'm going to stop there, because I know they're going to talk a lot about tools tomorrow for the future, and my job was just give you a brief introduction to the past, and I end up with this little bit of humor for those that will recognize the subtlety in it. You never try to predict the future, and you predict that you never will. Okay, so just a little humor there. So. Thanks, guys. We'll open up for questions.
We have a little time for questions, if you'd like to offer one, two.
But after you're from there, here he's kind of bad.
In addition to the increase in yield, you also see an increase in stability.
Okay, the question was, you get an increase in instability as you increase yield. Well, that's true, but if you look at Nebraska, if you take a look at Nebraska's irrigated production and Nebraska's dryland production, the increase in instability goes up as you approach the inflection point, because that's where it's whitest. And as you go the other direction, of course, you know, and your low yields, you're restricted by zero, right? Your variability is going to be near zero. You have a truncation there that you don't see as you move higher and higher yielding, and you get more variability from season to season. So I'm not sure that's a disadvantage, because you remember the old biblical constraint was you lay away the stuff from the good years to make sure you got some for the bad years. You just don't try to eliminate the total instability. If it means reducing your yields, you got to eliminate stability. So. It's just a personal philosophy I have on that, but the higher the yield for me, the better, even if it means the swings are larger.